Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about... Hi, I'm podcasting Great Scientists, a book. While I'm actually on the exercise book bike, it sounds rather sad, so you'll hear me hit the reset button. And I'll get it on. And the bottom line is that I've just got to really bore my way through and get up the kilometres. Now, unfortunately, I haven't got in with lubricant. So you'll hear this annoying zzz as I go along. And I'm deliberately just going to read through this and see what I've got. So I've set up the book in front of me inside of the exercise bike. Now, the general idea is I have to rehab and combine different activities together to get the greatest hit. And so this is a beautiful book called The Great Scientists, and it's well worth going through. There's a picture of a lot of people I don't recognise. There's Einstein, I think Boyle, Leonardo da Vinci, a few people at the bottom. Page of Darwin, and it's by John Fadden and Alex Wolf, Polish Capella, and it's published in 2005, so yeah, a little bit out of date, not really. So here's the introduction. Science has been around for a long time, since at least the days of the ancient Greeks. In addition, it's clear from consulting the archaeological record that the older Babylonian, Sumerian civilizations had rather more than a rudimentary grasp of medicine, astronomy and applied mathematics, not to mention engineering. From around the 6th century BC, however, we see signs of the ancient Greek world of what could have perhaps be called the first scientific revolution. No longer satisfied with gods as the ultimate answer to why the world is the way it is, Greek thinkers began to search for the underlying principle that would form the basis of a more satisfactory explanation. So this is really, for me, what Parmenides is such a fascinating person, right on the cusp between the two ways. The great tales of Mitus proposed that this prime substance was water. Anaxagoras believed it to be air. Xenophanes proposed a rather less glamorous option of mud. Democritus astonishingly proposed the first atomic theory. The word atom comes from the Greek atomon, literally translate indivisible. Just how inappropriate the word was would not be recognized until just how inappropriate the word would not be was would not be recognised until demonstrated in spectacular fashion by Ernest Rutherford from the 20th century. Now that's brilliant. That is, we can actually break up the atom. Isn't it beautiful though? I was just going on the internet and various things like that. Sorry. What we read in the works of these pre-Socratic philosophers we would not perhaps recognise as science. But we can see the glimmerings of scientific method in the rejection of the truth by authority and the search for causes and principles based on the observation with truth as the province of thinkers rather than of priests. And if I had to say a lot of corruption today, this is truth by authority. With the advent of Euclid and Archimedes, those monumental works of geometry and trigonometry, among others, are still required reading for mathematics courses today. We find ourselves in terra cognita of recognisable science. This is a rather good introduction. The progress of science from then to the present day has not always been straightforward, however. Science has frequently been in conflict with organised religion, and on these occasions, scientists have seemed to come off worst, not least because practitioners of religions have been prepared to resort to threats, intimidations, and even assassinations in order to preserve the religion's privileged position as the sole arbiter of truth. This is beautifully put together. at certain periods of history, several churches have detected the odor of heresy in scientific account of the cosmos, the origin of the structure of the earth, and especially the origins of humanity. Although, I must admit, the belief that the Catholic Church was, I don't know, church-like, is overlooks the how much more orthodox the Protestant Church was with Luther. Martin Luther was far more against Galileo than the Pope. Battered and bruised, though the times may have been, at the end of the 20th century, science has emerged as a victor, as a key intellectual discipline of the 21st century and beyond. The reason for this success can be said in two words: science works. The whole laborious scientific process, the testing, revising, discarding of hypotheses, the diligent construction of theories which fit the known facts, and the modification and abandonment of these, as well as new facts, and when the new facts emerge. The scientific method, in short, produces results which are testable, verifiable, falsifiable, and from the predictions can be made. Astrology, chiromology, creation science, divination, urinology, parapsychology, telepathy, ufology, and forecasting the weather from the entrails of sacrificial animals produce no such results. As has been remarked elsewhere, it's no accident that the societies which have actively embraced the scientific method have flourished, while those societies which have preferred instead to rely on superstition, witchcraft and religion have failed. The men and women whose biographies make up this volume have all made outstanding contributions to the field of scientific endeavour, have all shed light onto more or less baffling phenomena, and have all contributed to the ever-expanding pool of human knowledge. I think that's the story. This book makes no claim, however, to be a comprehensive list. There are many more scientists who could have been included by the same token. The book could have run to many hundreds of pages and still incomplete. Still, it does aim to spark a discussion on the nature of whiteness. Such discussion can safely be left to others. What it does hope to do is to give the reader an insight into some of the history's most influential scientific discoveries and discoverers, and to discourage him or her to take their interests further. Whether or not it succeeds in this aim then must be up to each individual reader to decide for themselves. What a beautifully posed and structured thing. I notice that. That being said, the back picture to that is a classical electron. Okay. Building on the work of early Greek philosophers such as Thales, Athanatus and Alexander, Euclid showed the events of the world could be understood by the application of reason after that, rather than appeal to gods. Euclid's axioms are the kernel of modern mathematics, and essentially the study of mathematics is the extent to what you can understand on the basis of the most reduced number of axioms, which are starting points. So rather than religion, you have these axioms. So this is really a real understanding of, you know, from the axioms what extends to it. And this is sort of pure knowledge. It's rather interesting in terms of that axioms exist devoid of the universe. It is actually pure knowledge. Okay. And it's interesting that previously they would have everything as appealing to the gods, so this is important. It is said that Euclid's great book, The Elements, is the most widely translated, published, and studied mathematical book of the Western world, and it is without doubt one of the greatest and most influential books of all time. I had read of it, it's not really good. The Elements is basically about geometry, the mathematics of shape. It is a thorough study that remains the basic framework of geometry today, thousands of years after it was written. Mathematicians still refer to the geometry of the flat surfaces, lines, points, shapes and solids as Euclidean geometry. And in the essence, the education department can't get past it. It's me speaking. In Elements, I summarise the most basic rules of geometry about triangles, squares, circles, parallel lines, and so that children learn it's all today. Which is true. So, a triangle is information which sort of exists outside there. I'm going to have to stop this soon, see how far, because my wife's coming back. However, the achievement was not Euclid's alone. He built on centuries of intellectual effort by Greek thinkers, dating back to the almost legendary Thales of Marcus in the 7th century BC. The Euclid's work encapsulated this approach to thinking in such a thorough and foolproof way that it is lasting, this is guaranteed. Benedict of Spinoza, Immanuel Kant, Abraham Lincoln are among the countless people throughout history to have been inspired by this way of thinking. Back podcasting after getting up to open the door and had a bit of a rest. Continue going on. My wife's not all that impressed about me podcasting while cycle, because people will think we'll be pretty awful at podcasting, but I'm doing as best I can. Euclid the man. Very little is known about Euclid himself. It seems likely that he lived around 300 BC. That would be around after Alexandria. In Alexandria, more obviously, if it's in a city founded by Alexander, has to be after Alexander. The great Egyptian city that when newly founded by Alexander the Great on the shores of the Mediterranean and the Nile, on my head. The first Greek ruler of Egypt, Ptolemy Sauter, 367 to 283 BC, created a museum and library in Alexandria, which became the remarkable intellectual educational institution of the ancient world, the most remarkable. And Euclid was probably the leading mathematician teacher there. He may have been a student there under Plato, when Archimedes arrived there not long after Euclid died. Oh, okay. I don't know with Plato. Plato means broad-shouldered because he was a wrestler. I like that. It's interesting that Plato was not considered an intellectual. There are a few hints about his character from an anecdote. Seems Euclid was a gentle, encouraging teacher. According to one source, he was the most fair and well-disposed towards all those who were able, in any measure, to advance mathematics, careful in no way to give offence, although the exact scholar never vaunting himself. I think this is what people don't actually understand about academics, that they're all tend to be quite gentle. Another source tells about what happened when a student, frustrated by the effort and learned geometry, asked what he would get from studying it. In reply, apparently Euclid called a servant. "Give him some money," he said. "Give him these coins, since he must gain out of what he learns." It's interesting because they also had Archimedes having a money-loaded expense. Is it Archimedes? No, Pythagoras, which is years before all of this. Another story tells how one day King Ptolemy asked if he had to read the whole of Elements in order to learn about geometry. Euclid diplomatically replied, There's no royal road to geometry. But this is pretty all much that is known. In fact, most of it comes from the writings of Greek philosophers, Phocaeus, who lived nearly 800 years later. So it's 500. This is at the start of the Dark Ages. So little is known about Euclid. Some scholars have suggested that the elements could be the work of a team of scholars who are working under his guidance. Others even that Euclid simply is the name for a group of Alexandrian mathematicians gave themselves. Whatever the truth, there's no doubt in the importance of the elements and the less known works of Euclid's lesser known. Euclid's and geometry. Euclid's great achievement was to combine the geometrical theorems of his day into a framework of theory and proofs, which is the basis of science today. Science of mathematics is the fullest extent of an axiom base. Geometry was already quite well developed by Euclid's time. Geometry of the mathematics of shape and probably began thousands of years earlier, arising from people's need to work out the area of land. It was developed to a sophisticated level by the ancient Egyptians, who used it to building the pyramids. They called geometry earth measurements, geometry, and the Greeks adopted the term. The word geometry simply means for earth measurement. Okay. In 1858, Scottish historian Alexander Rockman found a papyrus rolled, papyrus, the name of the reed the Egyptians used to make paper, written in the Egyptian scribe called Abrams around 1650 BC. It's interesting that we give the papier-mâché to the Chinese for some reason. This person's a full 1,300 years before. The Rheinberg papers and other papers now in Moscow, also known as the Moscow Papyrus, show the ancient Egyptians knew a great deal about geometry of triangles. For instance, they knew how to work out the height of things from the length of the shadow to the ground. In fact, Egyptians probably had a pretty good working knowledge of most geometric techniques described in the elements. Euclid and the ancient Greeks did was develop these practical techniques into a purely theoretical system, taking what might be called applied mathematics, creating what we call pure mathematics. It's interesting, sort of like, this would be unpopular, but a lot of the German science of World War II was adopted by the Americans. It's now known as American science. The Greeks researched for general abstract truths very much for their own sake. It's interesting that a lot of the Greeks disdained actual truth. Very interesting reading Parmenides on the subject. But what they discovered made their work far more important than an interesting intellectual pastime. Their method was such a powerful tool that the general truths it produced could be applied to every situation, which is opposed to, you don't have the sequence, you've got to rely on God a lot more, don't you? The method was, what was true about triangles in one situation was true of them in another. That was completely different. For instance, the Isles of Martis stunned the ancient Greeks. When he travelled there, by showing how a method of triangles could be used to measure both the height of pyramids and the distance of ships at sea. Okay. Now there's a page here, Euclid's windmill truth. And so this is some of the squares on a triangle, a right angle triangle. equal. So the sum of the shorter sides are equal to the sum of the hypotenuse. And just have a read through here. So this proof is based on there's 18 steps here to figure it out. I'll just read it here, but I think I can say it a bit better if I have a read through it. It does read across a bit of the line here. Both the ancient Greeks and the Babylonians were completely familiar with the notion that the sides of the right angle triangle are always the same exact proportion. It's exactly the same proportion. They knew the length of each side was always the same proportion to the squares of the length on either side. That is, the length multiplied by itself. Essentially, they knew what we call the Pythagoras' theorem. Okay. Just looking at here. This is the Winnell proof. So it's you've got your right angle triangles with the I don't know why they call it Winnell, but it's right angle triangle with the squares on the various sides, and it's based on is it similar triangles? So if they share two sides the same and the angle, one angle the same, the triangles have identical area. And so if you have the innovation of dropping a perpendicular from the right angle with the hypotenuse flat and the perpendicular all the way down, bisecting the not bisecting, but sort of breaking the bottom triangle in two, you create a system where you divide the bottom square up into areas. The bigger area is equal to the area of the bigger square, and the smaller area of the bigger square is equal to the other square, therefore proving Pythagoras' theorem. But in order to do this, you have to use similar triangles, and you have a construct here, and it's shown the construct here, where a triangle shares the length of the length of so it's a squared plus b squared plus c squared. A and they're constructed so they've got a and b at the same angle, so they're the same size triangle. And there's another theorem. So you've got two triangles out of that, and there's another theorem that I think it's the Euclid's theorem, I'm not sure. That if you've got a you've got two parallel lines, and on the bottom line you've got two points, and on the top line you have a point at any position. The triangle formed from those bottom to the top points are the same for all points in the top line. And so you can use that to prove that the two areas are the same by inspection. It's called the Winnell proof. Okay. Oh, it's written here. Postulates, theorems, and proofs. So that's a proof. You really have to see it. It's really hard to podcast that proof. But it's the fundamental thing is the similar triangles. But you also have to know that theorem that very few people know that as the area of a triangle between two points is the same. Hello, Dan. Postulates, theorems, and proofs. Euclid and the Greeks gave mathematics extraordinary power by turning it into a logical system. They introduced the idea of proofs and the idea that rules could be worked out biologically from a certain assumptions or postulates, such as a straight line is the shortest distance between two points. Assumptions are combined to make a basic idea or rule called a theorem, which is proved, disproved. So you've got to start off with the axioms, and then you can develop process. Okay, I might.
Cannot, Peter.
Okay.
I'm sex.
Okay, I'm
cannot
sorry.
Upload. Just promise me you won't.
Okay, I won't.
Do not upload anything you record in the next day.
Okay.
Absolutely not happening. Will you promise?
Yes, I will promise.
It's absolutely
okay.
Okay.
At the heart of Euclid, the elements are five key postulates or axioms. In modern terms, they are: one, part of the line can be drawn between two given points. Such a part of the line can be extended indefinitely in either direction. A circle can be drawn from... What, honey? What, honey? Okay, I'll have to stop. Now, starting up this podcast, a game of the great scientists. I'm partway through Euclid. I was trying to do it on my exercise bike, but as my wife pointed out, it sounded as though I was having sex while I was actually... reading it. You know, it's hard reading it, and I suppose what I'm trying to do is actually get the skill level up doing it. It was a bit difficult because the lighting was bad and all that type of stuff. So this is a bit more sedate. I'm outside in a beautiful sun in a lounge chair reading it. Now, the great thing about the people knew how to do and apply certain applied stuff. What Euclid did was really the birth of pure mathematics, and this is developing basic axioms, and from the axioms, building a structure of what we know as modern mathematics. So, this will be the difference between a tradesman and a mathematician. It's probably the first mathematician. So we had five postulates or axioms, and they are: a line can be drawn between two points. If you get two points, you can draw a line. You can extend that point line to an infinite line. Okay. Then a circle can be drawn with any radius from any given point at its center, I suppose, and this is supposed on a flat sheet of paper. All right angles are equal. If part of a line crosses other lines, so the inner angles of the same side add up to less than two right angles, then the two lines it crosses must eventually meet. That is, the right angles got this special property that makes the lines never meet parallel, which is great. The first four sound self-evident to us today, yet they are by no means self-evident to the people of the time. And it was Euclid's efforts to define the most basic concepts that made his work so profoundly influential. With only completely watertight definitions of the basic concepts, is it possible to establish firm proofs of otherwise vague hunches. And only with completely watertight definitions can we move confidently and logically forward through each step. Any looseness in the definitions immediately invalidates the chain of logic. And this is the idea of chain of... And Descartes moved this up to a more reasonable stuff. And what I'm going to try and do is, rather than exhortation reading, is actually add some more cognitive load to actually make it more interesting. It's also interesting to me to see how far I can read ahead. Parallel lines and Euclid's limitations. The fifth of Euclid's postulates is less self-evident and is about parallel lines. If part of a line crosses two other lines, so the inner angles of the same side add up to exactly two right angles, then the two lines must be parallel. Well, yeah, I suppose in multiple dimensions you can actually have it this skew. Okay. So parallel, this is all
paper geometry. So you can have two lines parallel, but then rotate one line around, and they'll still never cross, but they're not parallel. Euclid's geometers work perfectly for flat, two- and three-dimensional surfaces in almost everyday situations. But just as the Earth's surface is not actually flat, however much it appears to be, so space is actually curved in many more than three dimensions, including that of time. That's a bit of a weird way of putting it. I'm not really happy with them doing that one. Euclid's parallel postulates mean that only one line can be drawn parallel to another through any given point. If a space is curved and multidimensional, many other parallel lines can be drawn. Similarly, according to then that is actually quite an insight when you actually get down to general relativity. Similarly, according to Euclid's geometry, the internal angles of a triangle always add up to 180 degrees, yet those triangles drawn on a ball add up to more than 180 degrees. So eventually you have a ball which the sides of the triangle meet all points. The vertices are actually back wrapped around to one point, and if that one point is all triangles, you're basically going to go up to 360 degrees. That's just out of my head. Such mathematicians as Carl Gauss began to realize the limitations of Euclid's geometry in the 19th century and to develop a new geometry for curved multidimensional space. However, Euclid's work has been the bedrock of geometry for 2,200 years, and remains central to everyday geometry today. Moreover, Euclid's method for establishing basic truths is watertight reasoning, that is, by logic, deductive reasoning, evidence, and proof. It's a powerful tool, as it was, ever was. So powerful, we take it as basic common sense. Now, that's actually quite beautiful. So Euclid is the foundation of pure maths, and you really need that to get off science. If you don't have pure maths, I don't think you can have pure science. I think they should do that. Archimedes. Although Archimedes was amongst the world's most prolific inventors, he preferred to be remembered for his theories. His tomb was inscribed with a sphere and a cylinder, and the discovery of the ratio, which was one of his proudest moments. Quote, "Give me a place to stand and I will move the earth," Archimedes is said to have declared to King Heron II of Syracuse in Italy around 260 BC. So he's, if you imagine it's a generation, it's someone in World War II talking about World War I. What's really that sort of length of time between Euclid and the other ones? I think King Heron was the king of Syracuse. So you've got kingdoms, which are Greek, so they're by king, the head of state is the king. There's no, Greece is a concept, but it's not a concept as we know, understand as a country. So there's no Greek emperor. You had Greek as a culture, a fundamental thing. It was a federation of states, but it didn't form into anything. It's one of these things which is hard to really understand. To the astonishment of those present, so the story goes, Archimedes had just single-handedly launched the Syracusa, a 64-ton, one of the biggest, most luxurious ships built in ancient times. Launching the beach monster had defeated all efforts of a huge team of men pulling on ropes, yet Archimedes, with an ingenious arrangement of levers and pulleys, performed the task by himself with ease. No wonder when he was a legend in his own lifetime, with the tales of his genius spread far and wide. He was, without doubt, the greatest inventor of ancient times. Not only did he invent pulleys and levers to launch giant ships, but he built the first ever water pump, which is called the Archimedes screw, and still used in many places today. Which is that screw with the water being held. And it's actually a lovely pump. It's interesting that, although he did it in theatre, so there was no Greek. Sort of, it's interesting that today science progresses through military funding. Then there's no military didn't fund science, but theatre funded science. This is my view. He created a wonderful planetarium to show the motions of all the planets and invented a machine to fire burning pitch at enemy ships. and when his home of Syracuse was besieged by the Roman fleet, he constructed catapults to bombard the ships with the boulders, a mirror to focus light, and set them on fire, grappling devices to throw down scaling ladders, and he even took a hook and a crane to lift a huge enemy boats right out of the water and tip them over. Again, it's more, I suppose, more propaganda, more US propaganda, style propaganda. Yet, in some ways, Archimedes' inventions are the least of his achievements. Indeed, he himself did not hold them in much esteem. Like most Greek thinkers, he placed high value on abstract scientific and mathematical ideas than that of practical applications. The Roman writer Petrarch insisted that Archimedes, quote, did not design to leave behind any written work on practical inventions. He regarded as solid and noble the construction of instruments, and, in general, every art directed to the use of profit. He strove after those things which, in their beauty and excellence, remain beyond all contact with the common needs of life. Okay, so that's, you know, this is, can we have, I suppose the quote we have today, can we have innovation outside entrepreneurship? Like, is entrepreneurship bigger or less than innovation? I would say less, in my view. All we know of Archimedes suggests that Petrarch was seriously overstating the case, because Archimedes, more than any other thinker of his time, did not hesitate to build machines to try out his ideas and to construct practical experiments, and he was generally excited by his own inventiveness. All the same, in his purely intellectual achievements that were his lasting legacies and made him the greatest scientist in history until the time of Isaac Newton, who was in awe of him. Okay, it looks as though I'll have to stop here. In fact, Archimedes is the world's first greatest scientist. Other great minds before him studied scientific subjects, and there are many less famous Greek thinkers whose achievements in science deserve to be remembered. But he was the first person to think about problems in a scientific way, and we now take for granted his abstract theories could all be proved and disproved by practical experiments. His mathematical calculations, which is a method that he led to nearly every achievement in science today. Archimedes' life. Archimedes was born in 287 BC in Syracuse city in Sicily, which was then a Greek colony. He was Greek, not Sicilian. The city was a frontier town sandwiched between the warring powers of Rome and Carthage, and yet it was by no means an intellectual backwater. King Heron II and his son Gelon were enlightened, intellectually inclined rulers. Indeed, Archimedes may have been Gelon's tutor. Now, it is interesting in that this is really like California. I suppose not quite the same. All the same, if anyone wanted a proper education, Alexandria in Egypt was the place to go, and here Archimedes went as a young man. At the time he was there, the city was the greatest centre of learning in the ancient world. Although the museum or the university was barely 20 years old, the city itself had been founded by Alexander the Great just half a century earlier, it already held an unrivaled library containing at least 100,000 scrolls, including all of Aristotle's priceless press collection. I suppose it's not to be just old. It was here that the great... But you remember, a scroll is just a sheet of paper, all right? A scroll is not a long scroll, it's just a sheet of paper. Okay. It was here the great Euclid taught geometry, and Aristotle showed the earth revolved around the sun, and Hipparchus made the first ever great catalogue of constellations, categorising stars in terms of their brightness. And it was here that, much later, Ptolemy wrote Almagest, the most influential book about the nature of the universe for 1,500 years, up to, obviously, to after he wrote it, obviously not before, you know, so Euclid was probably dead by the time Archimedes was there, but Archimedes absolutely met, undoubtedly met, Eratosthenes, a brilliant thinker who measured the circumference of the world to within 4% of the bottom fingers, and made a measurement of the year's length to precise until it was barely so precise as any until barely half a century ago. Although Archimedes got his grounding in science and mathematics in Alexandria, his activity There was by no means purely intellectual. Some reports say he was employed for the time an engineer on large-scale irrigation works in the Nile Delta, and was probably while he was in Egypt that he invented the famous screw for pumping water. But once he had returned to Syracuse, he stayed there all his long life, inventing, studying, thinking. Accounts of his life in Syracuse paint him as an archetypal absent-minded scientist, so absorbed in thoughts that he neglected everyday needs. The famous story about him concerns a discovery he made whilst in a bath. King Herod had given a goldsmith some gold and asked him to make a wreath of it. When the goldsmith finished the wreath, Herod suspected the crafty goldsmith had pocketed some of the gold and replaced it with some cheaper metal. The wreath weighed exactly the same as the original gold. How could the fraud be proved? Herod asked Archimedes, and even he found it a tricky problem. Then, one day, while mulling over the problem of the bath, he suddenly noticed how the water level rose and sunk as rose as he sunk deeper into the bath. The story goes that Archimedes leapt straight out of the bath and ran naked through the streets to the king, shouting at the top of his voice, "Eureka, Eureka, I've got it, I've got it." Later he showed the king his idea. He first immersed the piece of water, a piece of gold that weighed the same as the wreath, and pointed to the subsequent rise of the water level. When the immersed wreath itself showed that the water level was higher than before, Archimedes said that it meant the wreath must be a greater volume than that of gold, even if it was the same weight. Therefore, it could not be pure gold. The fraudulent goldsmith was executed. Whether this story is true or not, it's typical of Archimedes' amazingly neat or elegant scientific solutions to awkward questions. Well, yeah, I mean, being true or not, it's pretty critical. It is typical of Archimedes' amazingly neat, elegant scientific solutions to awkward questions, and how small practical problem led him to crucial theoretical insight. It may be that this was the start for him, for his grounding in the work of hydrostatics and how things flowed. See the box on page 116. Mathematical insights. Archimedes also tried to approach problems mathematically. He may not have been the first to realize that a weight is put on each end of a seesaw. The lighter weight must be further away, so the heavier of the two weights are in balance. But Archimedes went further and showed the ratio of the weights to one another goes down exactly mathematical proportion with the distance to the pivot of the seesaw, and proved it mathematically. In the same way, he had a brilliant insight that every object had a centre of gravity, a single point of balance from which all seems to weights to hang, and again proved it mathematically. Interestingly, besides looking at a practical problems in a mathematical way, he looked at mathematical problems in a practical way, and this, if anything, was even more revolutionary, though it took over 2,000 years for other writers to realise it. The work that Archimedes was proudest of was his solution to geometrical problems, especially the problem of working out the volumes of areas of regular shapes such as spheres and cones. It's interesting that a disc, if you double the areas of a disc, so a disc has got a surface area of pi r squared, okay, top and bottom, it's 2 pi r squared, but a sphere is 4 pi r squared. So a hemisphere is double the surface area. Okay, some of his mathematical achievements were purely abstract. In the tradition, he showed, for instance, that the surface area of a sphere is 4 times the area of the greatest circle. In other words, 4 times the area of a circle of the same radius. He also showed that the volume of the sphere is 2/3 of a cylinder into which it fits perfectly. Indeed, he was so proud of this discovery that he asked the diagram of the sphere inside a cylinder to be inscribed in his tomb, and it was. But it was then, when he introduced the practical ways of working, that he achieved the greatest insights. The Greek tradition had disdained the practical. Following Plato, the Greeks believed pure mathematics was the key to the perfect truth and lay behind the imperfect real world, so that anything that could be not be completely worked out, you know, with a rule and compass and elegant calculations was not true. Archimedes' genius was to see through the limitations of this and realize just how much could be achieved through practical approximations, or, as the Greeks called them, mechanics. It's Hello.
Oh, hello.
All right.
Is this fine?
Yes, definitely.
How are you doing?
Okay, I'll just stop. It is clear he knew how much he was working against the Greek tradition when he wrote to his colleagues in Alexandria about a solution to a problem. This concerns a geometrical theorem which has not been investigated before, but has now been investigated by me. I first discovered this theorem by means of mechanics and then demonstrated it by means of geometry. This approach certainly bore fruit for Archimedes. For instance, he was able to work out the approximate area of a circle by first working out the area of the biggest hexagon that would fit inside, and then the area of the smallest that would fit around, with the idea in mind that the area of the circle must be pretty much halfway between. By going from hexagon to polygons, with 96 sides. There you go, 96 sides, that's sort of 96. That's 32, which is, it'd be interesting how that has gone. So it's obviously a triangle, hexagon, that still makes sense. Could narrow down the margin of error considerably. He found that the figure for pi of 22 and 7 that is still good enough for most mathematical calculations today. In the same way, he worked out the approximate area contained by all kinds of different curves and areas the rectangles fit into the curve. The smaller and more numerous rectangles, the closer to the right figure he got. This is the basis of what thousands of years later came to be called integral calculus. Oh, yes. Which became perhaps the most powerful tool of all mathematical tools for the science in the hands of scientists like Newton's and his successor. Death and legacy. By the time the Roman fleets besieged Syracuse in 1212 BC, Archimedes was an old man, perhaps nearly 80. But he was still actively inventive and busily at work on theoretical problems as his Roman ships closed in on the city. The aging Archimedes was in the thick of things, coming up with all kinds of ingenious contraptions to keep the enemy at bay. But even the genius Archimedes could not keep the Romans at bay forever. The Roman commander Marcellus had been so impressed with Archimedes' contraptions that he insisted the scientists should be treated well when the troops finally entered the city. Sadly, the Roman officer who came upon Archimedes had not got the message, of course. According to one story, the soldier first burst through the door and found him working in circles and making calculations on his sand tray. "Please do not disturb my calculations," he barked. The battle-wielding soldier was in no mood for argument and ordered Archimedes to come with him. Archimedes insisted on finishing his calculation first, so the soldier drew his sword and killed him. Sadly, despite his fame, much of Archimedes' work was lost and was only gradually recovered. Some important works have never been found. Remarkably, one major work was only rediscovered in 1906 when a Danish philologist, now this is information person, J.L. Heiberg, found that the medieval parchment discovered in the Jerusalem monastery was a palmipedist, that is, a scroll in which the original writing has been partially erased so that it can be used for new text. Here, beneath Greek Orthodox scriptures, were hidden copies of the various key works of Archimedes. Enough of Archimedes' work was kept alive by Arab mathematicians through the Dark Ages for it to finally be taken of advantage when the scientific revolution began in Europe in the 17th century. Galileo acknowledged his debt to the remarkable Greek scientists by saying, "With Archimedes, I would have achieved nothing." While Newton said, "If I had seen further, it's only by standing on the shoulders of giants." And for him, the greatest of all giants was Archimedes. Well, there you go. So, I thought it was Galileo was talking about Galileo normally. So, I'll see if I can finish reading this. Hipparchus and Claudius Ptolemy. Hipparchus, 226 BC, and Ptolemy 90 to 168 AD. were the greatest astronomers of the ancient world. Together, they were formed the basis of astronomy for the next 1,500 years. Hipparchus and Ptolemy compiled the first comprehensive catalogues of the stars and the skies, constructed systems for working out the motion of the sun and the moon, and much more. Besides, astronomy dates back to the very earliest days of humankind, when prehistoric hunters gazed up at the sky to work out which night and might give them the best moon for hunting. When people began to farm around 10,000 years ago, astronomy helped pinpoint the best time to plant a crop. It became so important that the astronomers often held the status of high priests, and many important ancient monuments, such as the pyramids and Stonehenge, have strong links to astronomy. So, by the time Hipparchus was born in 200 BC, astronomy was already an ancient art. Very little is known about Hipparchus, even though he's famous enough to be depicted in Roman coins after his death. So, was he Roman, I suppose? I don't know. He was probably born in Nicaea near Bithynia, now northwest of Turkey, by Lake Iznik. It is likely that as a young man he compiled records of local weather to try to link the timings of seasonal weather patterns with the rising and setting of particular stars. But most of his spell in Alexandria in Egypt, Ptolemy claimed that Hipparchus made many observations of stars from Rhodes. He died in Rhodes, perhaps around 126 BC. Our knowledge of his work is inferred rather than certain. Hipparchus' astronomical writings were extensive, that he published an annotated list of them. When only one of his works has survived, a short commentary on a popular poem called Phenomena by Aratus of Exodus, which describes the constellations. Although he tells us nothing about his astronomy, it shows something of his rigorous critical attitude to loose thinking, and ruthlessly points out the errors of the poem's description of the stars. Ptolemy described him as a lover of truth, and if he could be critical and judgmental, he was the harshest with his own work, always ready to revise his ideas as that new evidence came along. This is a bit like a filler. Hipparchus at work. Hipparchus was undoubtedly a skilled observer and saw many things in new for himself. But he also drew on a long history of astronomy from the Middle East, and in particular the ancient Babylonian records rescued from the ruins of the Persian empires after Alexander's conquest. In 1304 BC, he spotted a rare phenomenon, a new star or nova in the night sky. There was not another sighting until Tycho Brahe spotted one in 1572. It's said the extraordinary event was inspired Hipparchus to complete a catalogue of all 850 or so stars whose positions were then known. His catalogue, adapted by Ptolemy, is still in use in the 16th century. Indeed, it's so accurate that 1,800 years on, Edmund Halley was able to compare his map with Hipparchus' catalogue and see the stars change their position slightly over centuries. Hipparchus also compared stars by giving each one a magnitude number 1 from 1 to 6. Depending on how bright they looked, the brightest star, Sirius the Dog star, which he called a first magnitude star, the faintest being a 6th magnitude star. So it's 1 to 6, yeah. Although the scale has been adapted and extended, astronomers still use it today. So I really have to remember the absolute magnitude formula has a thing. I think it's a factor of 100 in every unit. So, one unit is 100 times dimmer. I'm not quite sure where that's true. It's not 10 times dimmer, but 100 times dimmer. Some sort of logarithmic scale. I'll have to look at it. What made Hipparchus such a great astronomer was his precision. Considering he was only naked eye and vague historical records to guard him, he made some astonishing precise calculations of movements in the heavens. We sometimes mistakenly think that the ancients had no real knowledge of where the Earth sits in the solar system, or even that it was round and not flat. But Hipparchus, with other Greek astronomers, so he was Greek, so for Roman coin, did have some idea, although it was not accurate. Hipparchus' only large error was to assume, like those of his time, except for Aristarchus and of Samos, that the Earth is stationary and the sun and moon and planets and stars revolve around it. But the fact that the stars are fixed in the Earth's movements, making such tiny differences to the way the Sun and the Moon and stars seem to move, Hipparchus was still able to make a highly accurate calculations of their movements. Hipparchus' calculations at the heart of Hipparchus' astronomical precision with a mathematical skill and rigor. It is said that he invented the branch of mathematics called trigonometry, the mathematics of triangles, and developed chords, the first trigonometrical tables, which helped him calculate the precise positions of stars and the size relative to the Earth and other stars. Some of Hipparchus' most important astronomical calculations came from plotting the ecliptic, which is the circular path of the sun through the sky. The ecliptic is an angle to the Earth's equator and crosses at two points. The equinox, and takes the sun furthest away from its solstice. Well, that's interesting. I suppose that would make sense. That the equinox. That's a new thing. I've got to remember, try and visualize that. Is it the sun? I have to really think about that one. I can't visualize it. So the equator and the eclipse where the sun passes the equinox. I suppose that makes sense. Yep. What intrigued Hipparchus was that even the sun apparently traveled in a circular path. The seasons, the time between the solstices and equinoxes, were not equal length. To pin this down, he worked out a method of calculating the sun's path, which would show the exact location at any day. He went on to measure as precisely as possible the length of the year. There are several ways of measuring the year astronomically. Hipparchus measured the tropical year, the time between equinoxes. The result from his own observations were inconclusive. But he could correct any of his errors by comparing them with ancient records. Thus he arrived at a figure of a year length that's just 6 minutes too long. It's an interesting story. The wobbling Earth. It's from the amazing accurate observations that came with perhaps Hipparchus' most famous discovery, the idea of the precession of the equinoxes. And when he calculated the exact time and position of the stars to the equinox, and compared it with the observations taken 150 years earlier, he discovered the stars near the ecliptic have moved their position slightly. After considering various explanations, he concluded that the whole star pattern is moving slightly eastward, and that it would go around the same position every 26,000 years. We know that this movement is caused by the slow change in the direction of the Earth's tilt, called precession, rather than a shift in the stars. But Hipparchus was basically right with his remarkable observation. So it's interesting that the star signs are incorrect by a month since Christ. 2,000 years, roughly, per month. To go per month. Oh, sorry. From this, Hipparchus went to study the motion of the moon in order to work out why eclipses occurred. Apparently, he only made little progress with the problem because he could not accept the theory that could not be absolutely verified from his observations. What he did do, however, was measure just how far away the moon was compared to the size of the Earth. To do this, he relied on a phenomenon called parallax. As the Earth moves, or, to Hipparchus, as the sky moves, objects in the sky nearby move slightly sideways compared to those further away. The more the object moves, the nearer it must be. Using complex and ingenious series of assumptions, he compared the size of the moon during solar eclipses, the same apparently as the sun, and the Earth's shadow on the moon during solar eclipses. In this way, he worked out the moon is about 63 times from Earth's radius away. It's in fact a little over 60. We know about most of Hipparchus' work, so that the moon is, well, let's see, the Earth is 15 million 150 million kilometres away, and the moon is 400, so what is it? We worked out the moon is 63 times the Earth radius away. Okay, that's allowable. So the Earth's radius is 66 sixes. Yeah, that's correct. Okay. It's not the the sun-moon distance. We know most of Hipparchus's work is only second-hand, as it appears in Ptolemy, for instance. But in January 2005, a real piece of hard evidence was found to show Hipparchus's reputation is not unfounded. Because the evidence of, that Hipparchus had really compiled an accurate star catalogue was vague, until the American astronomical historian Bradley Schneifer began to examine the 2.6-metre-tall Roman marble statue of the mythical Titan Atlas in the Farnese collection in Naples, Italy. The statue carries a globe which shows all constellations in exactly the right locations, as if they were taken from a star catalogue. By analysing the positions of the stars of the globe, Schneifer calculated the observations which dictated where the stars would appear on the globe, must have been taken around 125 BC, which is with Ptolemy's time. Ptolemy was, so just reading Ptolemy again. No, it's Hipparchus. So that's the end of Hipparchus. Okay, so this is, sorry, Hipparchus. This is exactly the time Hipparchus was working, and so provides strong evidence that he did produce a star catalogue. In the future, experts may compare the stars to the Farnese Atlas with those of Ptolemy's Almus, and see just how different they are. In the meantime, it indicates Hipparchus' reputation as the greatest astronomer of the ancient world is not misplaced. Okay, we'll read a section on Ptolemy. It's another section here. We know how Hipparchus works partly because it was developed by the astronomer Claudius Ptolemy, AD 90-16.8. He wrote four books summarizing Greek astronomical ideas in the 2nd century AD, including the famous Almus, the Arabic for the greatest. These works, in particular the Almus, became the quality of Western and Arab astronomy until the 16th century. Ptolemy was a person even more obscure than Hipparchus. We know he was Greek, okay, and he lived in Alexandria, but that's about all. However, the major work survived and proved to be hugely influential. The Almus proved a complete system for a complete system of movements of the heavens that came to be called the Ptolemaic system. It proved the basis of all astronomy until it was finally overturned by Copernicus in the mid-16th century. At the centre of the system was a fixed Earth, around rotates vast spheres containing series of layers and stars, the planets, the sun and moon, and this explains the movement through the sky and their rising and setting. It's, okay, I just don't word rotates a vast sphere, I suppose, okay. This, as we know, the planets do not appear to follow a perfect circular route through the sky because of the movement of the Earth. Instead, they appear to loop back on themselves every now and then, earlier in the day with the star wanderers. Ptolemy's system explained this ingeniously with a system of circles within circles called epicycles. So you need this if the Earth is going to be stationary. Rather like some fast celestial clockwork mechanism that continually whirs around. What was remarkable was how accurately it worked, allowing astronomers to calculate very precise predictions about where stars and planets would be. No wonder, then, even when Copernicus pointed out the fatal flaw, just as the Earth moves, the astronomers were reluctant to abandon it. Ptolemy's book Geography was, if anything, more influential than the Almagest. It was a collection of maps of the whole world as his contemporaries knew it. His great innovation was to record longitude and latitudes in degrees for 18,000 locations of his world map. 8,000. He also devised two ways of drawing lines on flat maps to represent lines of longitude and latitude on a curved surface of his globe. Of course, Ptolemy's knowledge of the world was no greater than that of any of his contemporaries, and despite the precision he could muster, the maps were wildly inaccurate. It's really interesting that the map preceded the actual exploration. Nevertheless, they were as good as anyone could make at the time. The geography became the standard atlas for another 1,300 years. Indeed, Christopher Columbus is said to have believed that he could reach Asia easily by sailing west across the Atlantic, simply because Ptolemy accidentally hugely underestimated the size of the world. And so, Columbus accidentally discovered the Americas while looking for Asia in the west. Just picking up, then I just ran out of energy, had a little nap, and I'm just going to finish this one off. Of course, normally, Ptolemy's knowledge of the world was no greater than that of any of his contemporaries, and despite all the precision he could muster, the maps were wildly inaccurate, as the information was working with. Nevertheless, they were good enough for anyone at the time to make geography became a standard atlas for another 1,300 years. Christopher Columbus is said to have believed that he could reach Asia easily by just sailing west across the Atlantic, simply because Ptolemy hugely underestimated the size of the world. And so Columbus accidentally discovered the Americas while looking for Asia in the west. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.